Knives, machetes, saws, and shears. Multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com. Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
There was actually quite a diversification of tarpon in the Cretaceous period. There was actually 14 different species of tarpon during that time period.
And their fossil record, their fossil records for all that?
Yeah. So I always joke, you know, if you ever find a hot tub time machine, you know, you want to go to the Cretaceous period, because at that time there was 14 different species of tarpon, you know, on the planet then. So
yeah,
that's
all
a great
you need
period
is a little boat and some horsepower and a fly rod, right?
Yeah.
This is the Tom Rowland Podcast. Fascinating stories to amaze, encourage, and inspire you in fishing, fitness, and the outdoors. And we're brought to you by Black Rifle Coffee. I started this podcast as a way to connect with my friends, people that I admire and respect, and you. It has been a learning journey that's made me a better person, a better fisherman, a better father, and a better athlete. I'm so happy that you're on this journey with me, and I'd love to hear from you with show suggestions, guest suggestions, or questions. The best way to get a hold of me is through text. You can text 305-930-7346 for the fastest response, but if you prefer to email, you can send that to podcast@saltwaterexperience.com. That's a dedicated email address just for the show. If you like this show, you can show your support by posting about it on social media and tagging me. Text the link to a couple of friends that may also enjoy it, and subscribe and leave a 5-star review if you feel like I've earned it. The website is TomRowlandPodcast.com, and that is where everything lives. All past shows, you can go and listen to any show. You can look up all the different shows that we've done, both the How-To Tuesdays, the full links, and the Physical Fridays. They all live on TomRowlandPodcast.com. And the social media is Tom_Rowland, R-O-W-L-A-N-D, on Instagram, or you can go to our big account, Saltwater_Experience. I hope to hear from you soon. So now, let's get on to today's show.
I'm Mike Larkin, and this is the Tom Rowland Podcast.
Mike, how you doing?
Good. How are you, Tom?
Man, I'm doing great. It's really nice to catch up with you. We were talking right before this about how long we've known each other and kind of been around one another, but it's nice to get you on the podcast here. I know you got some incredible information for us. So looking forward to it, man.
Yeah. Just really going to focus on tarpon and such a fascinating creature and a lot of science has been done on them. Thank goodness. There's still more to be done, but anyway, there's some really interesting facts.
Is that what you've kind of dedicated your career to? I mean, it seems like the majority of your career has been spent on tarpon or bonefish, or I don't know what other fish, but tell me about your career and how much time you put towards this.
Sure. I was really, really lucky. I did get to focus in the early stages of my career on bonefish and tarpon. In fact, my first job after college, I was working in the Keys for the state of Florida, the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. And then that's where I got hooked on bonefish. I didn't have a boat, I had a kayak, and as well as tarpon as well. And then from there, just kind of some research opportunities opened up at University of Miami for grad school. That I focused my doctorate on bonefish and tarpon. So I was really, really lucky. In fact, I'm going to age myself here, but I was one of two grad students to ever be funded by, now they're called the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust. But back when I was there, it was Bonefish and Tarpon Unlimited. It was me, the star guy, Robert Humston. We were the first two grad students ever funded by by Bonefish and Tarpon Unlimited back. That's what it was called when I started. Wow. And yeah, I was really, really lucky there and very fortunate.
What kind of research was some of the earliest stuff that you were doing for them?
Yeah, well, mine was really trying to do an assessment of the Florida Keys bonefish population. So, and I know this one is really going to focus on tarpon, and we're going to have another. We'll also talk about bonefish in a future podcast. But really, just trying to get. It was a challenge because you know they're not dead fish at the dock. A lot of the assessments they look at the size of fish, the numbers of fish dead at the dock, and bonefish is a primary catch and release fishery. So just trying to get different data sources to fill in the gaps, whether it's agent growth, whether it's mortality, whether it's recruitment. The tagging was a huge part of that. You know, looking at recruitment and looking at I can translate the length to ages, looking at the age classes in a fishery, estimate mortality. I was also very fortunate to work on the first ever satellite tagging of tarpon. So that was a lot of fun too, to see where they're moving and tracking them and learn a lot more about them.
How long ago was that with the first satellite tagging stuff?
Yeah, I put the first tag in 2000.
So
it was in North Carolina.
How much have things improved over since, you know, in the last 22 years?
Yeah, the tags have gotten smaller. The tags have gotten better. We used to have a joke at University of Miami. You know, when you're the pioneer, you're going to get some arrows in your back. And, you know, we learned a lot better about, how long should we deploy the tags? Where should we deploy the tags? Using the technology better. So we learned a lot along. We made some mistakes, but you're going to. And also we had some shark attacks, especially at Boca Grande, stuff like that. But we learned a lot about being more effective at tagging these animals and tracking them.
Nice. Did you have anything that really stands out as like the craziest piece of data that came in, like how far one went or anything like that?
Yeah. In fact, one of them, well, we had them, some tracks, they moved over 2,000 miles.
2,000 miles.
Yeah. From we're going from Mexico all the way up to Louisiana. We tagged them all the way down in Mexico. But one thing that really surprised me, surprised all of us, was when they were spawning, they would swim offshore. This was 2004, the first time we got data back on this. So let me take a step back. The tag has a depth sensor on it. Mm-hmm. It has a sunlight sensor. It even has a salinity sensor. And a light sensor. So we use that different pieces of the information to determine where the tag is located. We know where we tagged it, where it was recaptured. But anyway, we had fish tagged off Mexico, and they would swim offshore and go almost 300 feet deep. So that was really surprising us to think of think of more of a surface dwelling animal. Mm-hmm. I mean, not so, you know, within the spend most of your life in the first, 30 meters or 30 feet at least in the coastal surface, but they would swim offshore and make these deep dives almost 300 feet. Oh, it was really short too. They'd make it, for a couple hours and come right back up. Hmm. And we think that was related to spawning. And then, about 5 years ago in the Bahamas, they're putting similar tags on bonefish and spawning bonefish do the same behavior. So it was just interesting that we first discovered this on tarpon, like, what are they doing? And then bonefish do it as well. They swim offshore, they make these really deep dives. Maybe they're, we don't exactly know the complete reason. We have different hypotheses why they do this, but maybe it's, low predation down there and high survival rate for their young. They can avoid predators, all that, but they make these really deep dives. So that was really a surprise to see that behavior.
The first thing I would have thought of would be ocean currents. Like somehow they know that those ocean currents at 300 feet would wash their eggs fertilized eggs to somewhere. Somehow know that we couldn't possibly know yet. I don't know.
That's
interesting. Yeah. Well, listen, man, I know you've got a ton of stuff on tarpon. I want to get to it. And we talked about it a little bit beforehand about how your research and what your knowledge goes all the way back to the fossil record. So let's just start from the very beginning of tarpon and just bring us up to speed on what what you've learned about this incredible fish.
Sure. And this is really from me digging through the research. So I'm not really a fossil guy, but I dug into it and talked to many of the people that did this research, and it's really fascinating. So to take a step back, I'm talking about four different periods. So first period is a Jurassic period. Everyone probably knows that from Jurassic Park and the very famous movies. So that was about 200 to 145 million years ago. Then there's a, after that, there's a Cretaceous period, which is about 145 to 65 million years ago. And at the end of the Cretaceous period is when the meteor hit and most of the life on this planet died. And then earlier than that is a Tertiary period, which is 65 to 1.6 million years ago. And then the Quaternary period, which we're in now, 1.6 million years ago till today. But to go back to that, now that I explained those four periods. So tarpon first arrived in the Jurassic period. Now I need to be clear, this is the tarpon ancestors. So the first tarpon, so not Megalops atlanticus, not the one that we fish for today, but the tarpon ancestors first arrived in the Jurassic period, you know, swimming in the waters with T-Rex on land and, you know, very, very crazy time to be on this planet. So about 160 million years ago, the first tarpon arrived. And then you go through the Cretaceous and a lot of them, you know, mostly then the meteor hits at the end of that one. Most of the, there was actually quite a diversification of tarpon in the Cretaceous period. There was actually 14 different species of tarpon during that time period.
And their fossil record, their fossil records for all that?
Yeah. So I always joke, you know, if you ever find a hot tub time machine, you know, you want to go to the Cretaceous period because at that time there was 14 different species of tarpon, you know, on the planet then. So yeah, that's a
all
great
you need
period
is a little boat and some horsepower and a fly rod, right?
Yeah. And then, so then mostly, you know, after Cretaceous period, a big meteor hits, most of the life on this planet dies. But then the period after that, so it, roughly about 23 million years ago is when Megalops atlanticus arrives on this planet. So I always think of that as like, you know, when the first tarpon ancestors arrived and when Megalops atlanticus arrived, that's 137 million years of evolution. So that's a long time, you know, to get it right, you know, and then, so 23 million years ago, Megalops atlanticus shows up on this planet. Well, where were we? So humans didn't arrive to 6 million years ago.
Wow.
So they have a 17 million year jump on us, you know? So anyway, it's just fascinating. They've been on this planet for so long,
wow,
you know, and we're still the rookies on this planet trying to figure it out. Hope we don't destroy it, but they've been around a much, much longer than
I mean,
we have.
True dinosaurs, you know? In every sense of the word, right?
Yeah. The ancestors and it's interesting. You can dig through it and, you know, different tarpon that survived. So they all had, and one thing that jumped out at me when I looked through the different fossil records and the different drawings of them and pieces of them that they found, and they all have really large eye sockets. So I think they were even Megalops atlanticus today. So I think they were all visual predators, much like tarpon is. Vision was such a huge part of their feeding and survival. So that was one thing that was really interesting, that they all have these giant eye sockets. So again, I think fly fishing worked well for them. You know,
now,
if you ever
from the fossil records, can you tell that all of those 14 species were kind of air breathers, kind of like our Megalops atlanticus?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think you can, because it's only the bones.
Yeah.
And you'd have to have the gut contents and all that. So, in fact, to point out, if you ever fillet a tarpon, which we'll go into more of the details of the air breathing, but you know, you fillet a snapper or grouper, it's just like an air pocket, like a white air pocket just pops. But as we talked about, their swim bladder is filled with this lung-like tissue that they can actually extract oxygen. So I don't think we could ever determine that. But you know, looking at their mouths, they didn't have the upturned jaw yet that the tarpon have. They had it slightly, but not nearly as dramatic as Megalops atlanticus. So I don't think that they were air breathers yet, Tom. They came much, much later, but they had plenty of years to, you know, the millions of years to figure that out. So,
yeah. So from the fossil records, then where do we go?
So now, good point. So really now it comes down to, where are we today? So what do we have on our planet right now? So now we only have two species of tarpon. The Indo-Pacific tarpon, which is found off Australia, found in the Red Sea, found in the Philippines. And then, of course, Megalops atlanticus, the one that, you know, familiar in the U.S. and Atlantic waters and primarily in Florida. But the real big difference there, to me, that jumps out at me. They have different dorsal fin rays and anal fin rays, if you really want to get technical, but size. Unfortunately, the Indo-Pacific tarpon only gets up to about 24 inches fork length, so like total. Whereas the Atlantic tarpon has been found as far as you know, 9-inch fork length. Mm-hmm. So really, they don't get nearly as big as the tarpon that we get.
Now, when I was in Australia, we fished for a fish that looked exactly like a tarpon. It was called an oxeye. They called it an oxeye herring. Yeah. Is that the same fish that you're talking about? The Indo-Pacific tarpon and the oxeye herring?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's in our name for it. Yeah. Megalopsarpanoides is a scientific name, but yeah, you're talking about the same thing.
Those fish look just like the tarpon. They act just like the tarpon, except that they don't really spook that much. Like they were really aggressive. And when you would jump one out of a school, that, you know, now, you know, with our fish, that's kind of it. Maybe you get another one, but you're not going to get many more after that. That you just keep going like a school of Jack Crevels, just mean. I mean, maybe it had to do with the remoteness of the area that we were fishing, but you know, you can kind of see it in a fish when they have that tendency to just be kind of spooky. Like you could go and fish for bonefish, you know, somewhere that they've never seen a person, and you make four or five casts spooky to them, and they get pretty spooky pretty fast, you know. But these fish they didn't seem to spook. They were really fun to fish for.
That's so cool. You got the fish for him. I'm jealous. That's definitely on my bucket list.
Yeah.
Sometime to go.
Well, that's a great place to go, Australia. If you ever, we were on the Bay of Carpentaria, and it's like the United States turned upside down where Florida sticks off the north. They have like a peninsula that sticks off the north of Australia called Carpentaria. And that's basically their Florida. And it's very similar in a lot of ways. As you go north, the vegetation looks more and more and more and more like the Keys, and you see more palm trees and mangroves and all that kind of stuff. And the fishing gets more and more and more like the Keys as you go north. And it's very similar to Florida. Really cool place, and no one there. I mean, it's remote.
Yeah, I was going to say, does that have the crazy people like Florida too?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if they do, it's few and far between. I mean, we flew over that area and I'm just looking for anything, and there's not a light anywhere. You know, I mean, there just were very few people there. I think people go by boat, but I don't think people are really, or certainly when we were there, there weren't many developments or anything that people were getting to by land. You would see a little bit of boat traffic, but very cool area. That's cool.
But one more thing I want to point about Megalops atlanticus, the Atlantic tarpon, is so it's found on the West Atlantic, you know, Florida, Gulf of Mexico. It's also found on the East Atlantic too, so off Africa. Mm-hmm. It's even been sighted off Spain and Portugal. So, you know, it's actually on both coasts of, you know, Africa's West Coast,
right,
and United States' East Coast,
right. And then I guess a few are making it through the Panama Canal and establishing residency over on the other side there. That's interesting too.
Yeah. But then I was thinking, you know, go from species. The next thing is kind of their, I always like to talk about their life history. Mm-hmm. So really they, not to get too technical, but if you dig back in, there's some of these papers back in the 70s where they looked at tarpon and other, what's called a leptocephalus larvae. So it's really an eel-like larvae. It's a really translucent, clear eel, about an inch to inch and a half. The thing that jumps out with tarpon leptocephalus, they still have a forked tail. So think of like a clear eel, but it does have a forked tail, which helps you identify them if you find a clear eel. And bonefish and ladyfish also have that eel with the forked tail. But I was getting in the literature, their first stage, so they have different stages of this leptocephalus eel, but the first stage needs to be in very stable salinity. Then when they first hatch from the egg, they struggle to what's called osmoregulate. So they can't deal with changes in salinity. So meaning if they spawned in Florida Bay, or if they spawned in Biscayne Bay, and then the tide changes, salinity changes, they would either shrink or they would explode. So they just can't deal with that change in salinity. So they move offshore to these places with very stable salinity. So like there's four different spots that defined as their spawning locations, but that doesn't mean that there's only four. I think there's many more, just people haven't discovered them yet or talked about them in the literature. So there's many more, but anyway, in those four spots, there's like off of, like for example, about 120 miles off where I am right now. I'm in St. Petersburg, Florida, about 120 miles west of me is where they've been spawning, and you get real stable salinity when you get out there. But in the Keys, it's only like 10 to 15 miles out because you get that Gulf Stream. So you get a very stable swing. So they don't need to go that far off of there. But they first move offshore. They do that spawning. Then they form that leptocephalus larvae, that eel larvae, which is an excellent swimmer. It can cover a long distance. And they can stay in that phase for many months, like 1 to 6 months. And then they migrate into the coastal bays. And then they really try to look for really, you know, like oxygen poor, stagnant canals, stagnant creeks and stuff like that. Cause it gives them a big advantage that we talked about. They can air breathe. So they can go in there where the, you know, the sharks can't follow them and they can thrive off there.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
You know, and survive off other fish that can survive off low oxygen, such as guppies and killifish and mullet. So they're in there as well. So they have a prey source with low predation. So they go way back in those creeks and all that. They can air breathe and hide back there. And they spend the first three years of their life back in there. And then after 3 years, they're about 25 inches fork length. Ooh. Then they start to spread out and move to a variety of different habitats. You know, leave those creeks and or find other creeks or find ones that maybe not as stagnant and low oxygen as those. And then when they get to about 8 years old, then that's about 40 inches fork length. Then they become sexually mature and start forming, you know, you see the groups you see down in the Keys on the ocean side and hang on the bridges and stuff like that and move offshore. But what's interesting is their vision is also tied to this behavior as well. So like, for example, when they're really young, they're in those stagnant canals and it's really like a dark green water. Mm-hmm. So I need to take a step back to help your audience understand. So their fish vision is different than our vision. They can change the colors that they're the primary colors that they focus on that they see can change throughout their life, which is they actually have stem cells in their eyes so they can regenerate if their eyes are damaged to some degree. I mean, if you know, not dramatic, but and their color vision changes throughout their life, whereas different than ours, right? I think after like 6 months, our vision is our vision. It only, at least I'm finding out now, and it only gets worse with time, not better. But meaning our color vision is fixed, you know, and we actually see the primary colors of red, green, and blue. And then the other colors we see are kind of a mix of those three. So to go back to the tarpon, so their color vision changes throughout their life. So when they're back in those canals and those creeks and all that, they really see primarily green colors and blue. Those are the primary colors that they see. And then when they get to older, because also I want to point out in those little creeks, green color is very, very abundant back there. So that's why they see it very well. They do see different shades of green, but green is very common in those stagnant creeks that they're in. Mm-hmm. And then when they get to about 8 years old and 40 inches fork length, become those adult tarpon, they migrate out and they move to those oceanside areas. So then they actually have five primary colors when they get to that size and that age. So it's really green, different shades of blue, two different shades of blue, purple. And the fifth one is UV light. Now UV is a little hard to understand. We don't see UV light. I think of it as like a deep, deep, deep purple. But we humans can't see it. So, and the reason they developed that is because when they become adults and they move to those offshore areas, that UV light is very, very abundant. So, and there's different discussions in the literature, like why do certain fish see UV light. Some of the reasons are, you know, there's certain reef fish that, you know, they can reflect UV light. So maybe like fish that can see, like tarpon can see them, they can feed off those fish. But here's what I think is, this is my opinion, why I think they see UV light. So let's say, you know, you're fishing on the ocean side and there's a tarpon coming. That tarpon, you know, there's just UV light everywhere, that clear Keys water is everywhere. So now there's a crab in front of it, or your fly in front of it, right? So everything is UV light except for that silhouette of that tiny crab or that tiny flab. I'm sorry, tiny fly, excuse me. So really, I think it helps them, you know, feed on those tiny crabs when they're feeding in the passes, or luckily, you know, helps them see our fly when we cast it in front of them. It provides a silhouette because everything around it is UV light. So I think that really helps them see.
So would that make it actually somehow more difficult for them to see in the daytime? And then when that UV light disappears and you in the nighttime, you know, a tarpon is such an efficient predator at night. And like, if you ever go to Key West Harbor at night or Long Key Bridge or any of these places, it just sounds like a bomb's going off. Boom, 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 yeah, boom, yeah, boom. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're eating everywhere. And a lot of times it's when it's really dark outside. I mean, they're not, I mean, sometimes you're thinking, okay, well, they're seeing a silhouette of a crab with the moon, right? But other times it's just really dark and they're just crashing stuff everywhere. They obviously see really well at night.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You bring up an excellent point. So that was really daytime, but they have, yeah, you're right. They have incredible low light and nighttime vision. And we know that because of all the high density rod cells, those light detecting rod cells, they're very dense in their eyes. So they also have that, what's called like that tapetum, like that reflective tape. Like you ever see them at night and you shine a light, their eyes glow.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
When you shine them. So really, it maximizes the light going through and back. So it's like a reflective barrier. So it maximizes the light that they capture in their eye. And so they're really, in fact, I mean, they're excellent vision, but they're really primarily from those light detecting cells is primary nighttime feeders. I mean, they can see so well in low light in nighttime. And the other thing is, if you like, you probably have in Key West, but when I was in Miami, you know, you look off the bridges at night and there's always lights on the bridge and you look down and those tarpon are right in that shadow line, right in that dark area. Or there were some areas in Biscayne Bay where they were hanging out right in the shadow of the mangroves. So they're hanging out there. And really in those low light conditions, tarpon can see the prey better than the prey can see them. I mean, their eyes are so good at that low light condition. So they really thrive in those shadow lines, whether from the mangrove or from hiding from the lights.
I always thought about that, like us wearing a hat, like, you know, the sun's coming down and you can see okay. But if you block that out with your hand or with a hat, or, you know, you put your hand over the sun, you can see so much better. And so they like, you'll see them, like the bridge will make a shadow line and they'll be lined up right on that shadow line. It's crazy. Obviously an advantage for them in some way, but it might also just make them more comfortable. Now, before we move on from the vision, so you talked about how we know that they can see really well at night by the density of the rods and cones in their eyes. But how do we know, like, what colors the tiny tarpon can see and what colors a 40-inch tarpon can see? How do you determine that?
They're really from analyzing those cone cells that they extract from the eyes. So the guy that did this work, Scott Taylor, so I would actually, I would provide him. We had unfortunately, some tarpon that died from shark attacks and so forth. And I gave him bonefish and tarpon eyes, and I would have to remove them. So he would actually get the eyeball, he'd fix it in a certain solution, and he would actually extract the cone cells. And from there, he could actually detail, he could analyze those cone cells to see what color they were specific to. So
why are our baby tarpon flies and mid-sized tarpon flies and big tarpon flies, why are they all a million different colors? Because it seems like they can only see certain colors. Maybe we ought to rethink this a little bit.
Yeah. But you know, it is interesting though, before this research, but another side of that is before this research came out, I think it came out in like 2009 when it was published. And I really doubt all the guides are either following this or reading all this literature. But if you look, I remember looking at fly boxes like back in the 2000s and seeing those chartreuse colors and seeing those blue and seeing those purples. So it kind of made me, you know, this is before the research was done. So I think a lot of guides have keyed in on it. But you know what, a lot of it is I know, you know, like a lot of it, you know, where you put the fly and how you move it. And
yeah, but and, I mean, you can have a great angler that can put it where it needs to be. And you do that over and over and over again. And then you change the fly and boom, they eat it and they see it. And there's this definite reaction. Like, I don't know what's different about that, but that worked. So we're sticking with that for a while. And then you stick with that for a little while. And the next thing and you think, oh, we got this thing wired, right? Like every fish is going to, maybe the next two fish just kill it. But then maybe something changes. Maybe it's the UV light that we can't detect and they're not interested in that anymore, you know? And it's just, it's just a very strange thing that keeps you going back, I guess. But the, you know, the guys that kind of gravitate towards the chartreuse, I mean, you know, chartreuse is a color that we've been using in fishing for ever, right? Like that's like a fishing color. So eventually you're going to start tying some flies out of it. You're going to start using chartreuse. It's one of your go-to colors. If you grew up bass fishing or anything like that, that's one of your go-to colors. So you throw it out there and it works. I mean, you don't really need to know that they have cones in their eyes that see this well. It's like, I don't really care. That works, right? But now what's interesting is looking at this from a scientific basis and saying, okay, well, that seems to make sense that they like chartreuse because of these rods and cones that you've been able to determine. What other colors do they see like that? That's what I'd be wondering right now. Like, like, is there something else? Like purples, have you mentioned purple? Purple and black have always been a good color.
Yeah, purple sea. Mm-hmm. See purple very well in the blues. And, you know, one thing I like too about the non-scientific thing, but I like chartreuse, but I like it because I see it too.
Yeah,
right.
Me too.
I mean, I can see where the fly is. So that's a big advantage too. I feel like I know where it is, you know.
I see orange even better. Like in particular when we're barracuda fishing and you have those longer chartreuse flies, and it's really important to see where the fly is in relation to where the fish is. But I determined a while back that I can see orange better than I can see chartreuse. And it seems like a barracuda like both of them. So I started tying my flies in orange just so I could see the fly better. Just me personally, but some people see chartreuse better.
Gotcha. But another thing I want to point out with the vision is they have. So I remember when I provided Scott these eyes, I would put I'd actually put a marker on it, put a marker on the bottom of it. So when he analyzed it, he knew, okay, where's the top of the eye? Where's the front of the, where was the, you know, where was the right, where was the left? So he would know exactly where these density cells, whether the rods or the cones were located. And one thing he found was that they really have excellent vision up in front of them. And so directly in front of them, whereas you find when we get into other species like ladyfish and bonefish, they can see more around them better. But tarpon, their best vision is directly in front of them and slightly above. And I think a lot of it relates because they're, some of the literature calls it a suction strike. Like when they heat, you know, they open up, they flare out their gills, they suck in water, they feed like directly in front of them. So I think, and that relates to, you know, what their vision is, as well as their mouth morphology too, right? Like they're not sucking on the bottom, you know? So I always joke, you know, like when I was reading that, like, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've yelled at people, you know, put the fly in front of the fish, right? And well, it's true. I mean, actually, that's where their best vision is too. But I'm sure you've heard that or said that. I've had that people tell me that as well. But with tarpon, that certainly is the case.
And they can
their
see
best vision is directly in front of them,
and above them, even out of the water. And you see that, like if you're at Hawks K or Robbie's or whatever, and you move your hand like you're going to throw something, and all the fish they're like a dog, like, you know, they like look like expecting you to do it. Jack Crevel can see them even better, I think. But it's amazing how they can see out of the water.
Yeah. True. And then also a point when they do feed, just it relates to that suction strike thing. They have if you ever open their mouth, they actually have two plates on the roof of their mouth and then the tongue. So they actually crush a crab with their tongue and the plates on the roof of their mouth. And bonefish do this as well, but bonefish have actually little teeth there, but tarpon have plates there. So Anyway, but you know, that plate, you know, as you know, it's difficult to set the hook because right. you're just hitting a plate, you right. know, you're not hitting tissue. So, but that, you know, adds to the challenge of tarpon, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Cool, man. So what about, the lifespan? Like we were talking about, the life, is that where you go from here? I don't want to interrupt your flow.
No, that's great. So, so it is interesting. Yeah. How long do they live? So, and tarpon are a real difficult to age. I worked on it years ago. Because even though for their large animal, their otolith is really not that big. And it's relative to their size.
Is like, the bone in their ear, right? That you can age
a
tree.
I'm sorry.
No, it's
sorry.
Cool. I just want to make sure that people are following what we're talking about.
Yeah, I always assume like, you don't know what an otolith is? But anyway, it's the bone in the ear. And you take it out of their skull. And take a step back. It's really... it really helps with their hearing too. Otolith is like a dinner plate surrounded by nerves. So, and when those vibrations hit the skull, now they're, you know, us, you know, we live in a very different density. We live in air, right? Well, they live in very dense water and their body is a very similar density to the water that they live in. So those vibrations will actually enter the skull and it'll move that dinner plate, which is the otolith, which is surrounded by nerves. So if it, you know, shakes it a lot, it was a loud noise. If it shakes it a little bit, it was a low noise. And otolith also helps them with orientation too. Like when the otolith is resting on the top, the fish knows it's upside down. But there's some interesting facts I like to point out about otoliths. But they actually deposit, they're constantly depositing calcium carbonate onto this otolith. And people have used this to their benefit. They can actually see what in other elements as well. They can use that to see, you know, what's being deposited on the otolith and you know, where were these fish? Were they in the bay? Were they offshore? But anyway, for that size of a fish, they have a very small otolith. Like a bonefish otolith is fairly large for its size. So when you cut it open, what you have to do, you have to cut it open down the core and put it in a microscope and read these lines. And what you're really counting is winters. So how many winters has this fish been alive? Because in a winter, their growth slows down and they get this tiny little band. That tarpon migrate. So it makes it difficult. Like even though, you know, they do, you know, they migrate, they follow these temperature profiles up and down the coast. So they don't really experience that. They're like snowbirds. So, you know, in the summer they go north and then when it gets cold, they move south. So those bands are really, they're not really that defined. But anyway, there was some age and growth work. The point I'm getting to is they're difficult to read. So they found them about 50 to 60 years old from reading the bands. But then what's really neat is that some chemists grabbed the otoliths and did a different type of analysis. So you can actually see how these chemicals, the radium inside the otolith, when it decays to lead, it decays at a constant rate. But anyway, what I'm getting at is you can look at that decay rate and see how much it's decayed at the core when the tarpon first was hatched from the egg. And then you can determine the age to see the decay rate. But that analysis showed that they live up to 78 years old.
78 years. Wow.
Yeah. So it's really, I mean, I always, you know, my kids have hooked a couple. They haven't caught any, but I'm like, that fish is older than you. That fish that you just caught, you know, and I'm sure I've caught tarpon that are older than me.
For sure.
You know, so they can live up to 78 years old.
Let's talk about that. Like a full grown fish would be 78 years old now. Is that one that we've actually aged a 78 year old?
Yeah.
Okay.
So yes.
And did that come out of the wild or out of an aquarium or where does that come from?
That came from the Florida Keys.
From the Florida Keys. So that's like a record fish or one that died somehow
from the wild.
In a tournament or something from the wild. Okay. So what, like the fish that, you know, you see predominantly migrating through the Florida Keys are anywhere from 60 pounds to 100 pounds, right? So that's your typical migrator, I would think, on the ocean side. Later in the season, they get a little smaller. But a fish like that, let's just say for good measure, 100-pound fish. How old is a 100-pound fish?
I'm actually cheating right now because I have a chart in front of me on my computer. Because
you
really,
can share it if you want.
Well, there's a lot of variability. Yeah, actually, I can share that real quick because there's some interesting facts about this. Here, hold on a second here. So here's, hopefully you can see this now. I'm sharing my screen here. Mm-hmm. So this is tarpon growth. So on the x-axis is age in both figures. But on the y-axis on the top figure is fork length. And then the y-axis on the bottom figure is weight in pounds. So, but what's interesting too is, so I want to put that 100-pound line that you just talked about, Tom. So, So I also need to point out, so the males is the blue and the girls are green. So when you say 100-pound, what's interesting first is that, first of all, males rarely get over 100 pounds. In fact, this is a sample of over 300 fish. There's one blue diamond in here. They rarely get over 100 pounds. Wow. And the reason for that is males are more interested in the sperm doesn't take up a lot of space, but for them to be reproductive successful, they just need to spawn as many times as possible. Whereas the females, they have the eggs. So think of eggs as marbles. So they want to have the biggest cavity you can. So meaning if you have a coffee cup, you can hold, let's say 100 marbles, but if you have a bucket, you can hold like 2000 marbles. So the benefit for reproductive success for the females is to have a larger cavity, is to be larger. So in the case of tarpon, those larger fish, like that 78-year-old fish, that was a female. So females are larger. So 100 males don't get that big. They rarely get over 100 pounds.
I mean, it really looks like, from the data you're looking at there, the blue really stops at like 80.
You're
seeing a few fish over 80, between 80 and 100, a little outlier over 100. But for the most part, the primary data is really 45, maybe 50 pounds to 80 pounds is where this chart, if you're not watching this on a video, he's got a couple of charts. One is age and the other is tarpon growth. The blue represents the male fish, and the green on this represents the female fish, and the larger fish are predominantly female, like majorly. I mean, almost none. So this data that we're looking at here, where these are all tagged fish or
these are
fish that died.
These are, I'm sorry. So they're all wild. These are all dead fish.
Okay.
So mine from taxidermists, from tournaments, where they killed the fish and removed the otolith from its skull.
Right.
So,
okay, cool. So,
and then,
go ahead.
I was just going to point out real quick, there's also a lot of variability too. Like those lines are really the curve, the best fit to this data. Like what's the best fit for the males? What's the best fit for the green one is best fit for the females. But, it's just like, if you would go to like my son's eighth grade middle school class, if you took a measurement of length, they all may be 13,
right?
But there's a lot of difference in ages. So there's always some variability, in it. So the curve is just kind of a way to visualize where's the most likely a given a certain age, what's the most likely weight? That's what the blue curve and the lines in this figure.
That's
the
interesting.
Green line and the blue line.
One thing before we move on. How has it affected the data collection that we almost don't kill any fish anymore? Like in the past, I don't know when all of this data was collected, but it was very common to kill a fish and take it to the taxidermy. It was very common to kill them in tournaments. It was very common just to kill them and hang them up on a nail at some point. And then the laws change, and then the ethos changes, and we don't really do that anymore. It's very rare to see that happen. Incredibly rare. So how does that affect science?
You're exactly right. So if you're doing this today, it'd be very, very difficult, because back then, you're right, when they did this in the 90s and even before that, when they collected the database, they had dead fish from the FWC tagging program, where they, you had to have a tag to kill a tarpon. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They would collect those otoliths from those fish as well as taxidermy. But you're right, today, I mean, I don't even think that they get many of those tagged fish from the FWC tag program. So it would be very difficult.
Well, good thing we have this data, though.
Sample size.
I mean,
yeah,
because it seems like today you're like, oh, no, there's no reason to kill a tarpon, but we know so much from these tarpon that were collected at some point that there was good that came from it, right?
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. Yeah. And quick story, I was doing a similar thing with bonefish, and it was very difficult because back in the 2000s, but we'll get into the, when we talk about the bonefish one, but then I had this like overwhelming thing with the cold kill, where I had like 200 bonefish within a week. But anyway, that's another story for another time. But you're right, it is very difficult for being a catch and release fish. Like if you're doing this for snapper, right, you could go to the dock and just sit there all day and collect otoliths. But you're right, for tarpon, it is very, very, very difficult.
Cool. So let's go back to the difference between the male and female. The females are obviously getting bigger. The males are staying smaller, but the age is relatively the same. They can both live really long time. Males and females.
Yeah, I'm not sharing my screen anymore, right?
No.
You got the screen?
Yep.
Okay. But you're right, you're right. But even the females seem to get a little bit older too. You know, I mean, the males don't seem to be living as long. Just from the sample size we have, it looks like the oldest males are around in the 40s. Whereas the females we talked about can hit 50s, 60s, 70s. So they do seem to have a, not only the males smaller, but they also don't seem to be living as long.
Do you have any data on whether there are more males than females? Is it a strategy of the species to have more breeding females or more males? Like you see that sometimes with like deer populations or other things and people try to get rid of some of the, you know, of one species, you have too many or something to, you know, in a management kind of situation. But I wonder if we know anything about that with tarpon.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't know of any, because don't know if there is more females than males or something like that, sex ratio. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and to really do that, you'd have to like find a school and net them and then look at the sex ratio. Cause this data is biased, especially coming from taxidermists, right? Like, what are you going to bring to a taxidermy? You know, you're going to bring the biggest fish that you can.
Right.
Right. So therefore you're bringing in females.
Right.
So now they did try to, you know, sample FWC actually collected this data and they did their best to sample different ages. But when you are still getting supplementary data from taxidermies and so forth, there is a bias there.
Right.
And so you're definitely getting more females. So I don't know. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer. There are males, more males than females. I'm assuming they're kind of equally distributed. But to answer that question, you'd have to really net a whole school, net a whole bunch of them, and then sex every single one.
How do you sex a tarpon? Can you sex a tarpon and then release it, or is that something that you have to kill it?
There are some aquaculture techniques where you can flip it over and essentially shove a needle up its anus and take a sample there, you know, but I don't recommend that for anyone, but unless it releases the white milt, then you know, it's a male,
right?
You know, if you're picking or it's next to the boat, I mean, I don't recommend ever picking a big tarpon out of the water, but if you release the white milt on your boat or somewhere near, then
we used to pick them up, you know, all the time. That was just the kind of the thing that you did before we knew what we know now. And you would see that, you'd be like, whoa, like this is a family show here. We're going to need to get some different kind of pictures, but you'd see that with other fish too. Like, you could see it with a lot of different fish. So I don't know where you go from here, but obviously one of the things that I'm most interested in is what we know about the migration and where these fish go, how far they go. Like, what do you know about that? Because that's the big mystery. Like they're all here and then they're gone and then they're none. And then all of a sudden here they are. And it's one of the great mysteries. Like when they're not there, where are they? And
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'll get into that because we had some real fascinating results. So again, to remind the audience, so these data loggers, and we call them a satellite tag, but when the fish is underwater, it's essentially just recording data. It's not actually, when it's underwater 20 feet, it's not telling us where it is, because that big body of water is blocking the signal. So what happens is, you know where you tag the fish and you know where it were captured. And then when it pops off, we actually would go get it, because when it pops off, it sends data to a satellite, but sometimes that gets pretty choppy. We get bad reception or whatever. So we would actually go out, collect it and download it. But then you get this data logger, which has, you know where you tagged it, where it's captured. It has a light level sensor. From light level, you can determine where you are. You know, are you north up in Cape Cod, or are you down south off Cuba? Hmm. You know, from that sunrise and sunset, it gives you a rough estimate. So it also has a selenometer, measures the salinity. So, you know, was it offshore? Was it way back in the bay? In fact, I mean to brag, but one of my colleagues, Jing Yang Liu, he discovered that it really has a a connectivity sensor on it that can be used to measure if the tag is on land or not. When it's automatic on land, it starts sending data. But Jingyang dug into that that sensor a little more and found out we can use this to measure salinity.
Wow.
So anyway, it has light level, a temperature gauge, you know, the temperature, a depth sensor, and salinity. So you use all that information to find out where it's located. Like if it's in, you know, 40 feet of water, you know it's not in Florida Bay. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can really use all those different pieces of information, the temperature and the salinity. We can, there's water.
Day and age of GPS, why wouldn't it be able to be located by latitude and longitude?
Well, there is for those, we call it a spot tag. So meaning when the fish rolls, mm-hmm. then it can send a signal to the satellite. But they do tow. But the early ones that we used, you know, they're underwater, so mm-hmm. they, you know, the water blocks.
Right. So what would cause one of these tags to detach from the tarpon? Is it on a time basis it's going to decay, like whatever the mechanism to hold it in there is going to decay and break off at a certain kind of, like we want it to be there for a year or whatever. And they're designed to fall off at that period of time.
Exactly. Yeah, it'll tell it, okay, we want it to pop off like August 25th in 2022. And then we'll send a charge to, there's a pin in it. Excuse me. There's a pin in it, and it'll send a signal to that pin, and it'll actually corrode, and within about 10 minutes, it'll break off.
Wow.
So there's also a sensor on it, like meaning you can program it. Like if it's sitting on the bottom and the depth doesn't change, you know, for more than 4 days, then go ahead and activate that signal, because it's essentially, you know, like a dead fish at the bottom mm-hmm. somewhere, mm-hmm. you know. So
what if it's in the belly of a hammerhead shark?
that's a great question. So we had one it was actually Boca Grande, which probably doesn't surprise many people on here. But anyway, we tagged the fish up Boca Grande, and then it popped up early. Like it was only on there for about 2 months. That was only like a month, and it popped up, and it showed, the data was fascinating because it had depth changes. So it was changing depth. The salinity was like fixed. But the light sensor, it was completely dark for about a week. So I'm like, how could you find a spot in the wild that is completely dark? And then we looked at it, and it was scars on it. So really what it came down to, it was in the belly of probably a hammerhead mm-hmm. for about a week. And then the shark threw it up. So wow. It was just interesting that the light sensor was zero. And then all of a sudden everything, you know, and the depth will change because, you know, the shark is going down deep, the shark is going back up.
And, so and that's not something that you find on a regular basis. That just happened kind of once or.
Yeah, it was about 10% of those would had issues. It was a lot higher percentage at the beginning
right.
when we first started. But yeah, I mean, unfortunately there are, and these are fish, you know, like even we had one off, off Amarada with a channel 5 or something, but you know, you see the fish swim away, you're watching it, you know, for, you know, a good 20 minutes to half an hour. And okay. I mean, maybe not that long ago, but you try to follow it as long as you can, but then you find out, okay. But then 2 days later it got sharked, you know? So, and you know, this because the tag's all chewed up, or you can definitely see some evidence. And we work with some guys at University of Tampa that would analyze the marks, and they can even tell us, oh, that was a bull shark by the marks on the tag.
Wow.
That was a hammerhead. So unfortunately you do get some shark attacks, but to go back to the, now that I explained, you know, how you get that data. So really we tagged all over from North Carolina, a lot in the Keys. Cause I mean, we were at University of Miami, so that's, you know, it's close by. It's easy to drive to Texas, Mexico, and try to summarize some facts from the satellite tagging. So we had, we've had some fish that can travel over 2,000 miles, you know, not in a day, obviously, but mm-hmm. throughout their migration.
So that 2,000 miles was Mexico to Louisiana. Is that the one you referenced
yes.
earlier?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. And some also went 20 miles in a single day. And what we found is that, you know, a snowbird, so they would migrate, you know, we'd tag them in the Keys. We'd some fish go all the way up to Chesapeake Bay, you know, that far north. So like and they would follow that at 79 degrees Fahrenheit temperature. Hmm. So they
water
they
moved right?
up north. Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Water now, water temperature at what depth? Are they following? Are you able to tell that? Like they want 79 degrees, but are they willing to be at, you know, 100 feet to get that? Or do they want to be up close to the surface or what?
Well, most of the depths were within, it was like 30, 30 feet or less. They spend most of their time in 30 feet or less from the surface. So the depth did change some, but it would go up because they would roll, especially at night, they'd go up and down, mm-hmm. but they really went beyond that 30 feet. So they would stay in that top 30 feet of the water column there. But one thing I thought was really interesting, which I think needs more study, but like, so we tagged them on the west coast of the Gulf of Mexico, so Mexico and Texas, and we tagged them on the east coast of the Gulf of Mexico, so West Florida, the Keys. So for some reason, all the fish we tagged, Louisiana is like a temporary boundary, not a real boundary, like a wall or anything like that, but meaning like the fish on the west coast, the Mexico and Texas seem to be its own stock. Like they would move up to Louisiana and then move back to Mexico. They wouldn't cross over, meaning a Mexico fish wouldn't cross Louisiana and go all the way to Florida. And then the Florida fish would go up to Louisiana. I'm sure they all mix off there. There's a Mississippi River, there's a lot of bait fish and stuff like that. But there was like two stocks of fish there, like two separate subpopulations, which is what we found. I'd like to see that further analyzed, but meaning the West Coast would stay with the West Coast tarpon and the East Coast would stay with the East Coast. Like we never had a tarpon that went from Florida, went all the way over to Texas.
Wow.
And we never had a Texas tarpon that went all the way over to Florida. So they seem to like, they move up to Louisiana, they mix there, and then they go back.
That's
so
crazy.
Fish goes from.
Cause I just did this thing with the FIU, scientists there, and they're doing this thing on Jack Crevel. And the one Jack Crevel that they found that went the furthest went from the Florida Keys to Louisiana. And I wonder if they're going to find the same thing. Like they're starting to tag in Texas. And I wonder if those Texas fish go to Louisiana and then go back to Texas. I wonder if Louisiana is not, and it's just, it would make some sense because that's the largest river in the country. It dumps right into the ocean right there. That amazing things happen there. Like, it would make sense that would be a migratory place to go and then back down. I don't know. Why do they roll? Why? What do you know about that?
So really, tarpon, you ever, you know, fillet a grouper, snapper, you know, that a swim bladder is just like a white balloon, mm-hmm. and it just pops. But tarpon is different. If you ever fillet, well, hopefully, you know, if you ever, I know people don't like filleting, but you ever have a shark attack one or something, you know, if you look at the insides, well, first of all, it's fascinating. They have this webbing material in there. So they're really, you know, for them, they can handle it when they jump. Their organs aren't flying around. They have some webbing material to secure their organs in the inside. But then when you go to the swim bladder, if you cut it open, it has this lung-like, alveoli-like material in it. So they can actually swallow air. They can breathe it in, swallow it, and it goes to their swim bladder. And then from there, they can distribute that to their body. And I have some... When you do fillet them, I filleted some over the years looking at research. They have some special arteries that can actually distribute that oxygen from that swim bladder throughout their body. So, but
really, can you see that it specifically goes to their brain, like up towards their head area?
It distributes it throughout their body, throughout their muscles, throughout their tail, which was critical to us. Cause when we tag tarpon, we're learning as we go, like you tag a tarpon and it starts bleeding. Like you can't believe, I'm like, what's going on here? And then when we started, then I filleted one, I caught a baby one and sacrificed it. And I could see where these arteries are located. So really, when you go to put a satellite tag in a tarpon, it has to be in a specific spot because you don't want to hit those arteries. Mm. So that's really how we discover.
And where do you tag them? Where is the place to tag them?
Right, in front of the very front of the dorsal fin, right down there. So
where would the place? In front of the dorsal. Where would it be not to tag them? Where are those capillaries or what? What is?
Yeah. So you don't want to go in too far in front of the dorsal fin because there's actually an artery that runs right along the top. It's only about 2 to 3 inches from the top, depending on the size of fish. And then it actually kind of like loop goes up a little bit. The artery follows, and then I can even show you. I have a picture, but it's kind of gory. But anyway, you can actually follow it. It goes up around the dorsal fin and then back down. So really, right where that dorsal fin starts is really when you want to tag it. You don't want to go too far in front of it or too far in back of it because you run the risk of, you know, hitting that artery and then you have a lower chance of survival rate.
That's super interesting. That'd be like somebody catching us and hitting us right in the femoral artery. And here, we're going to just watch where you go. Yeah. Gee, thanks. I'm bleeding out, man. Like, that's a terrible place to put that. Can you put it anywhere else? One thing that you mentioned is that they have a webbing that's holding their internal organs in, which makes them able to jump and be acrobatic like that. There are other fish that are acrobatic, kind of like a tarpon, not quite to the level of a tarpon. But is that something that is common with fish that jump, like that type of webbing thing? What is that called? Do you know what that is?
I've seen it. It's a good question. I'm sure there is a scientific name for it. I'll just call it webbing. But I was on a boat one time that caught a marlin, and we were in Mexico, and they wanted to eat it. So I remember seeing the exact same webbing in the abdomen of the marlin. So that's really, it's cool. Basically, so, you know, when you jump out of the water, so it's the organs are secure. They're not like hitting against, you know, the right and the left and all that. So they're actually quite secure. So I would argue that I haven't done that looked at all fish that jump, but I would think that they all have some type of webbing in there to secure their organs. Mm-hmm. So they don't get any internal damage, right? When they're going nuts.
Interesting.
Out of the water.
Because they're obviously using that. I mean, that wouldn't be something that they evolved to have because of fishing pressure. They're obviously jumping, you know, while they're eating, they're jumping. That's something that they're doing on a regular occasion. You'll see free jumping tarpon. You'll see free jumping marlin, free jumping sailfish. You'll see free jumps when it's happening. So that's something that they have. And then I guess when they feel a hook or whatever, they're going to go to jump because I don't know, that's what they do. Kind of like a mullet.
Yeah. I think it's like a stress response I think it can give them advantage too, right?
It also works. Like, it works pretty well. They often get away.
But it's all, I remember my son hooked his first tarpon, and my daughter was right next to us, and it jumped, and it just scared it. It's completely scared. It's such a fascinating thing, you know, see this big tarpon jump out of the water. Like, it just adds to the tarpon fishing experience, right?
Yeah. 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 So we were talking about rolling. Did you finish what you were talking about rolling?
I didn't. I'm sorry. I always go off on a tangent. But so why do they roll, right? So tarpon can breathe two ways. The gills is really the primary method they're going to use throughout their life for breathing. But they also have that lung-like sunbladder. So there's some fascinating research done back in the 70s of all time when they looked at, you know, why do they roll? And they found there's three variables why they roll. So one, low oxygen levels, like they go back in those stagnant canals and all that. But you can use that. So I'm sorry, I'll go make it three ways. Low oxygen levels, to adjust their buoyancy, they'll actually swallow it and use it to either add air or you know, remove air from their abdomen. And also imitation of they imitate each other. So the first level, you know, low oxygen levels, you know, that's a huge advantage. They can go back in those stagnant creeks and avoid predation from sharks and everything, and go those areas with there's plenty of other fish for them to eat. Like mullet can survive in real low oxygens, and guppies and killifish, they get prey in there. But another thing is you ever notice like they roll more in the morning than in the rest of the day, because at nighttime, you know, the sun's down, right? So photosynthesis stops. So they actually, from our tagging data, they roll a lot at nighttime because the oxygen level has gone down. There's no photosynthesis going on. So then in the morning, you know, the sun's up, but they're rolling, but the, you know, photosynthesis hasn't kicked in yet. The oxygen level is still low. Wow. So they roll a lot, but then eventually photosynthesis kicks in and all the oxygen starts being generated in the water. So that way
to a tarpon, would that feel like, you know, if you're in a real stuffy room or something and somebody opens the door and you get all that fresh air, like, would that be kind of what that would feel like? Like all of a sudden you can breathe and you don't have to roll, and because that's what happens. I mean, you're fishing for them from before sunrise to about 8 o'clock, and they're rolling like crazy. And if it's super cloudy, they'll keep rolling. But if that sun comes out and the sun comes up, it's done. I mean, it's done sometimes before that, like 7:30. You'll be lucky to see. I mean, they'll roll occasionally here and there, but do you think that's kind of what that feels like? All of a sudden the water just has more oxygen in it. Like all of a sudden, just like, that's awesome.
I think so. But I would say the roll I'd take a step more is more like a shot of Red Bull. Cause I think, you know, water's got about roughly about 1% oxygen, but air has 21% oxygen. So you get a lot more oxygen from the air than you do the water. So, you know, I think one thing, you're right, when that photosynthesis kicks in, you know, they could breathe, they don't have to roll as much. But on the other side is, you know, when you're fighting a tarpon, you know, the fish is, you know, fighting you, it's being exhausted. You know, that oxygen gives it a huge advantage to extend the fight, because now he's gulping, he or she is gulping 21% oxygen, mm-hmm, instead of trying to drain 1% from their gills. You know, so it gives them, you know, that's why we fight them for an hour and a half sometimes.
Yeah. The other thing that you see is, as they're moving down the ocean side, or if you've been fortunate enough to see a big school of tarpon offshore, like sometimes if you're at the reef, you'll see 500 tarpon coming in, and they are rolling like crazy, just rolling, rolling, rolling. And I've always thought that was like, you know, like us running a marathon or something, or running a 5K, like all of a sudden your breathing starts picking up and they're rolling and they're moving. And you can see that school is moving through there. It's moving at miles an hour and they're rolling like crazy. And then you see them at, like, you know, Bahia Honda or someplace like that, where the current is really ripping through there, mm-hmm, and they're holding there, and fish are rolling everywhere. Like, they're everywhere rolling. But is that because they're having to hold in that current, or
no? I think you're exactly right. Yeah, they're exerting more energy. They need more oxygen. So, mm-hmm, yeah, and it's a big benefit to get that 21% air versus that 1%. Especially, you know, the hotter the water, the lower the oxygen content. So even if the water gets super, super hot, you know, the oxygen level goes down in that water. Even with photosynthesis, the oxygen level that the water can hold goes right down. So they can really take advantage of that.
How much does it matter that the wind is churning up the water a little bit? Like, if you got a little rip, it's blowing 15 or 20 versus blowing zero. Because on those days, the fish are rolling everywhere. Like, obviously you can see them much better, but if you're out there a lot, you're like, okay, well, they're just rolling more today and I can see them better. But the fish are rolling everywhere.
You're saying they're rolling more on a
slick calm day, right? Slick calm, right? And then on a windy day,
yeah,
they'll still roll, but you don't see them rolling as much. It's also harder to see them, so maybe they are. I don't know, but it seems like,
no, I would think definitely
the wind would be churning that up and providing oxygen to the water more so than on a slick day, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the oxygen content will be a lot higher during a windy day where it's all turned up and stirred up, versus that flat calm day where the sun is just beating down that water and jacking up the temperature and lowering the oxygen content. So So you're right. They'll roll less during that windy, mm-hmm, day versus a flat calm day there.
Gotcha. And then the last thing that you said was to mimic each other's behavior, right?
Yeah. But before I go into that, we'll talk about the buoyancy. So, and you've probably seen it, like they use it for low oxygen levels, they adjust their buoyancy and imitate each other. So the second one, adjust buoyancy. So, you know, they'll roll, and then you've probably seen it, like that breadcrumb trail of
absolutely
bubbles.
Yeah.
What they're doing is they'll actually expel it. Okay. It just swallowed a bunch of air. It has too much, so it'll expel it out of its gills. So you can use that to your advantage too, if you try to, you know, follow that breadcrumb trail. Like, I know they're going left. Mm-hmm. I know they're going right.
Yeah, for sure.
Breadcrumb trail.
Catch a lot of fish like that, because, you know, if it's low light in the morning and they roll and they take a right and you cast to the left, they don't see the thing. They don't see the fly. But if you can watch for those bubbles, that absolutely works. Now, they can continue moving that way and then turn, and sometimes it doesn't work exactly right, but it gives you an idea anyway of where they're going.
Yeah. But they get into the imitation thing. So it was a really interesting study back in the 70s where they didn't know, you know, what causes them to roll. Is it visual? Is it the water line? Is it sound? You know, so what they did was they put tarpon next to each other, but they all were in a different tank. So they could see each other through the glass, but they couldn't hear each other. The water line wouldn't pick anything up. And they would imitate each other. If one tarpon rolls, you have a 70% chance that the tarpon next to it is going to roll. So, and then what was really funny about this paper was they took it another level. Like, okay, so they're imitating each other. So they actually made a wooden tarpon and painted it and put it in there. And they would actually they put a little string on it and would raise it. And if it raised and went up the surface and went down, like the same similar behavior to a tarpon, then the one next to it would roll. And then they did it with a spatula. And the same thing, if they raised it and lowered it at the same time. So it was just funny that, you know, they could imitate each other.
That's the new, thing that we need to have. We need to have something that yeah, you go out there, you're like, I wonder if there are any tarpon here. Let's put out the decoy and make it roll. Hey, listen, people, there are a lot of tarpon fishermen that their brain is turning right now. They're thinking, decoys? Yes, I use them turkey hunting. I use them deer hunting. Why not? Why wouldn't we use one tarpon fishing?
I never thought of it that way, but yeah, you just, so that's your test to see if they roll.
Yeah.
Cause they do imitate each other.
You could do that. You could do a little decoy, experiment just like you did with a spatula and everything. You just go to, you know, one of the docks like Hawks K or Robbie's or whatever, and put in your fake tarpon and make it roll and see what happened. That's what it's like to be a scientist.
If you do it, I could, yeah, give me some royalties if you ever sell it on, you know, on your.
I'll put you on there.
but that's it for the rolling. Just, you know, use it to your advantage, you know. Go, if obviously, you know, the early bird gets a worm, and I know tarpon guys are always out there at sunrise because mm-hmm. you see them roll then, right? Mm-hmm. And then look for the breadcrumb trail of bubbles, and they imitate each other too, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool. That is cool. The tarpon is a fascinating fish, and it's one of those fish where kind of the more you learn about them, the more you realize there is to learn. So as a scientist, like when you're learning these things about, you know, you've seen one travel 2,000 miles. The Florida fish seem to go to Louisiana and turn around and go the other way. I don't know what we know about them going up the other coast, like up towards Maine and all of that. If there's another big river, that they kind of turn around, or if it's just colder temperatures that they just maybe don't like, but I know that they've been seen way, way up there. But as you learn,
they have,
like
yeah.
all of this kind of these things that we're learning, does it give you hope that one day we kind of figure this fish out? Or is it like, man, the more you learn, the more mysterious this fish actually is? Like, what is your kind of, where do you sit with that?
Yeah. The more we learn, the better, right? I definitely, feel that way. And then, you know, we did have them go up the Chesapeake. We think they're up there feeding off, prey items, but yeah, it's just such a fascinating fish, and that's been on this planet much, much longer than we have been. So the more we learn, and this goes for probably all fish, you know, like I'm not a fan of ignorance, right? The more we know, the more we can manage them, the more we can try to make sure they're around for generations to come. So it's definitely to our benefit to learn more about them.
Nice. All right. Well, if we could do one more thing,
I did remember one last thing about the satellite tag.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot to mention. So to go back to that, so where do they disappear to? So we had some very interesting results. So, you know, where are they like overwintering? Mm. You know, and we had a group of tarpon hang out about 30 miles west of Naples. So, and then they would move into the Everglades. So it's just interesting that they're out there. Where are they overwintering? And then also, I went to a conference, and there was, some video of some divers recording them in the winter. So we're talking like, you know, like January, February off of the, what's it called? The oil rigs there mm-hmm. in like 100 feet down. And, I don't know, somehow they claimed that there's warm water there, which I don't understand the physics why warm water is typically at the surface, not 100 feet down. But anyway, it's just interesting. There's still a lot more overwintering in hiding spots. We need to learn about them, but the fascinating that they were 30 miles off of Naples there, well, as you well know, off at the oil yeah, rigs.
That is super interesting. And right before we started this, we were talking about one of the first times that we encountered one another was when you were fishing with Billy Pate a lot. And, he wanted to come down to Key West and fish with me. And we never got that going, but I wish that would have been a great opportunity to fish with Billy Pate. That would have been amazing. But when Billy was doing his videos, the 3M tarpon fishing videos, he did two primary, and he kind of alluded to the fact that these tarpon migrate. This is what we know about them. And back then, maybe this was the common belief. I don't know. But they swam off the coast of Africa. They swam all the way up here. And then they just appeared in Florida. And I was always kind of trying to put that together in my head. Like, okay, it's, you know, March and you're not seeing a lot of fish. And then you get a nice day and here they are. Now, how did those fish know that it was going to be nice today? Like, I don't buy that they were swimming from Africa and they just showed up on this nice day and every other nice day they show up. Yeah. Like they're, I was always under the impression, like there's got to be a place where they're just a few miles off the ocean side. And then a nice day comes up and they push in, right? Like that just made way more sense to me than all of a sudden they just kind of, corresponded that they would make this big giant migratory move. And you would see them in the wintertime and, you know, you get a nice day in January, you get a nice day in February, and they would just push in. And then as soon as that next cold front would come in, they'd be gone. So what about those fish? Like, I'm sure that there is this migration that's a real big, long migration. And then there's probably, it seems like there's other behavior where there's maybe, you know, they just kind of hang out 30 miles off Naples and then they push in and then they go away and then you don't see them again. And did they swim to Africa? Like, I don't know. Like that's the mystery here. And that's where that was kind of the common belief a long time ago that there was just this, it was like a bird migration. They just keep going and keep going and keep going. They might go 2,000 miles and some of them probably do, but maybe do all of them do something like that? Or is when you learn the about those fish off of Naples, like, does that kind of give you, like, I bet there's dozens, hundreds of places like this where these fish
sit. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. But I don't think they come from Africa. I think Billy did that long before we did the satellite tag. And I was really lucky to be able to work closely with Billy and fish with him and stay with him. And that was really a blessing. You know, because I was, you know, I have his videos too. I probably have in my storage.
I could probably tell. I could, if you don't have them, I can recite them verbatim. I watched those things back and forth. It was so long and big around as my waist. He points to it behind him. It was the greatest video of all time.
And I remember when I met him, I was nervous and I was like, so cool to meet him. And I was telling my friend, like, dude, this is like you meeting Michael Jordan.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it was just such an experience to, and then I got to stay with them and fish with them. But anyway, no fish are moved. We haven't seen any fish move from there. Certainly are tarpon over in over off the west coast of Africa. And then we haven't had any fish, you know, make that migration across the Atlantic. There is a chance that the larvae may, though. There's some currents that come off Africa and their larvae can live up to 6 months. So there is a chance that tarpon larvae could come over. But in terms of the big ones, but, you know, we've always wondered where they were too, you know, overwintering. And then we found that spot, you know, 30 miles off of Naples there. And then we saw the, you know, the oil rigs. But I think you made a great point. I think there's many other overwintering locations. We just haven't discovered them yet. Just like there's probably many more tarpon spawning locations. You know, we have four, but that doesn't mean that those are the only four. Like, I think there's more. We just learn more and more as the tagging and the research continues.
Got it. Very interesting. Yeah, that's so cool, man. Well, I'm really looking forward to talking to you again about bonefish. I know this is going to be a very popular podcast because everybody that listens to this loves the tarpon. And why wouldn't you? They're an incredible, mysterious, amazing fish that is incredibly rewarding to catch because they're so acrobatic and sometimes they're so easy and sometimes they're so hard. And like, they're just like the ultimate game fish, in my opinion. They eat basically everything, including tiny little things that look like flies. So they appeal to everybody.
Yeah, I agree. Nice. And they've been around a long time, a lot longer than we've been on this planet.
I know.
So we got to give them respect for that.
Give them respect and take care of them. Make sure that they're on this planet for a lot longer. All right, man. Well, thanks for this. I really appreciate it. If people wanted to check out any of your stuff, I know you said you weren't on Instagram, but is there, you got anything people can check out?
Yeah, I guess if people had any questions, they could email me at elopomorph@gmail.com. And I'll spell it real quick. It's ELOPOMORPH, elopomorph@gmail.com. I'm always available for questions and more discussions about tarpon. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. The non-scientific people, what is an elopomorph?
Oh, good question. That's the suborder of tarpon and bonefish.
Nice.
So that's what I like, because no one else has it, but yet it's a suborder of tarpon and bonefish. Like if I ever get a boat, that's what I'm going to call it, the Elopomorph. You know, but no one else, you know, it sounds like a, no one else knows what it means, but I know what it means.
Just add Elopomorph. Just don't put just add. Like that's my pet peeve on boat names. Like just add salt, just add water, just, you know, real salty, R-E-E. You'll be real Elopomorph if somebody else has it, right? Like, I don't know. It seems like
they're probably, people are probably putting it in their boat right now. Unfortunately,
they are
with that name soon.
But you know, they'll just have to be real Elopomorph. You'll be the original.
I'll be the OG, the original one.
Yeah. All right, man. All right, Mike. Thanks, man. I appreciate it, and we'll get together for another one on bonefish in the next couple of weeks. So look forward to that. All right, that's it for today. See you.